Look at now more broadly societal matters, dealing with a number of societal issues. One of the reasons why the copies of the scriptures were so expensive was part of the reason was simply the nature of life in the Roman world. 90% of the empire were poor. 90% were what we would describe today as in that poverty level, of whom half of those, 45 to 50%, were slaves. And the Roman experience of slavery is very different from ours. The European experience of slavery in the last 250 years was rooted in ethnic issues, and really had, I think, its foundation in racism. The Roman world is very, very different in that regard, which in the Roman world, the Romans conquered whomever. They enslaved a significant portion of the population. Didn't matter who you were. There have been, I think convincing arguments that racism as we know it, which deals with ethnicity and skin color, is really something unheard of in the Roman world. The Romans were convinced of their own personal superiority to every other people group in that world, but it was based on culture and language, not based on ethnicity. And thus the appeal of evangelicals, for instance, in the 18th and 19th centuries, back who supported slavery here in this country, back to the Roman world, were actually very misleading, because there are significant social differences between slavery in the Roman world and slavery as it was experienced in the more recent past. 90% then of the Roman world were poor, of whom 50% were slaves. 50% of the entire 100 would have been slaves. So about half of the Roman world was enslaved. Population numbers are not easy to fix. For most of the period of time, we're looking at about 70 million, 60 to 70 million in the Roman world that the Romans ruled over. At the time, probably a fifth of the world's population, maybe more, maybe a fourth. Of the remaining 10%, 8% would be middle class, what we call middle class. The middle class really is an invention or a byproduct of the modern world. Much of the past history, once you get beyond 1500, you're dividing societies into the very wealthy and the poor. And such it was in the Roman world. 8% would be middle class, 2% were wealthy, and fabulously wealthy. Tremendous gulf between the rich and the poor. Many of the rich owned huge estates that spanned thousands of acres, employing thousands of slaves. One ranch, for instance, in southeast Italy had 250,000 head of sheep. Just one ranch. What we would describe as a ranch. That's an enormous, enormous number. The first emperor, Augustus Caesar, all of Egypt was his own personal property. When he conquered Egypt with his legions during the last bout of the Civil War, the first century B.C., by the way, the Roman world was convulsed with civil wars. The central figure in that, obviously, we remember as Julius Caesar, but there were a variety of other generals vying for power. It issues in the collapse of the old Roman Republic, which was an aristocracy, and the emergence of the empire with one man ruling the empire, the emperor. And in the last stages of that, Augustus Caesar conquered Italy, conquered Egypt, and kept it as his own private farm. And
who was that?
Augustus Caesar, also known as Octavian. And so the Roman world then was one in which there was a tremendous divide between the wealthy and the poor. The wealthy, very small percentage. The poor, large, large numbers, most of the empire. What that means then is that in most of the congregations in the early church, most of those people would have been poor. Good number of slaves. What it does not mean is what certain scholars have argued, but have increasingly now is obvious, it does not mean there were no wealthy in those early congregations. It's often Paul's statement where Paul says, not many noble, not many mighty in this world in 1 Corinthians 1, has sometimes been taken to mean, oh, well, there were none. But Paul does say not many. There were some. And we'll see evidence of that as we go on. Enormous difference then between the very wealthy and the very poor. The reliance on a slave economy also meant that to some degree Roman technology stagnated. No need to be creative in technology when you've got all kinds of human manpower. And the ancient church then is, the ancient world is one, and therefore in which slavery is taken for granted. The ancient church, the early church, also takes it for granted. And I think there are intimations in Paul's writings, we won't get into this, I think there are intimations in Paul's writings that he did not view slavery as a positive institution. I think Philemon, 1 Corinthians 7, 1 Timothy 1, which talks about kidnappers, slaves, those who kidnap slaves, I think that the Scriptures view slavery negatively. Revelation 18, 11 to 13, those who barter in men's souls are part of Babylon that will be destroyed. I think there are intimations, but that was never fleshed out in the early church. And the church that we're going to be looking at then is a world in which there are slaves and sometimes masters in the same congregation. And sometimes interesting scenarios. We do know, for instance, one of the early key elders in the church in Rome in the early 200s was a slave. His master was a believer. And so, a very interesting situation where the slave was the spiritual elder of his master. And that sort of thing, which would never, ever have happened in the European experience of slavery in the last 250 years, was part of the early Roman experience, which would have led inevitably to a breaking down or a relativizing of the institution of slavery. And then the Roman world is a patriarchal world. This differs from area to area. Probably the strictest area in this regard is the Greeks. For instance, a Greek woman who was a respectable woman would never, ever have dinner with a male who was not part of her family. It has never happened. When she went outside, she would be veiled. That's if she wanted to preserve her reputation as a respectable woman. In fact, in the Greek homes, there would be a separate quarter for women, which there was no access to for males who were not part of the family. This would mean then it would be very difficult for pastors to minister to women in their congregations in the Greek world, which led to the arise of what we would describe today as deaconesses. That is definitely an order that was within the Greek-speaking Christian churches after the year 100, where you would have women able to minister to other women, simply because it was not going to be very easy for a pastor to visit women in his congregation to whom he was not related. Now, when you come to the Roman world, that's very different. In the Roman world, women would frequently eat with men who were not part of their immediate family. And that would not be regarded as not a respectable activity. And so there was a degree of freedom that Latin, Roman-speaking women had that Greek women did not have. In Egypt, again, it was even more different. Women could actually be involved in ruling in the larger culture, and Cleopatra being an example. And so you have different degrees of freedom regarding women's involvement in the larger culture. Christianity will impact that to some degree. The Apostle Paul in Romans 16 certainly recognizes the importance of women's ministries, women to women, women to children in his letter there. Galatians 3:28, in Christ Jesus there is neither male nor female. That is in terms of their spiritual standing before God, their access to God. Women can approach God by faith in the Lord Jesus Christ on the same level as a man. In those areas, Christianity would be quite different from their surrounding culture. Biblically, obviously, the emphasis that men are to be ruling, teaching elders, that position is not open to women. That would, in one sense, people coming out of that world would not find that strange at all. And the only groups in which there is any challenge to that biblical injunction would be among the Gnostics, the second century heretics. For whom some, they argued, women could be teachers. And then it's a world that is quite different from ours in this regard, is that politically it's a military dictatorship. It is not a democracy. Democracy is an experiment that was tried by the Greeks. The Athenians had tried it in the 4th and 5th centuries B.C., and it had failed. No major Greek thinker, political philosophers like Plato or Aristotle, or any of the Roman philosophers like Seneca, believed that democracy was a viable political institution. They either opted for some sort of benevolent dictatorship, Plato, or some sort of benevolent oligarchy with a few, the aristocracy ruling. The Roman world in which the church emerges is a military dictatorship. There is one man at the top, the emperor. In Roman history can be divided really into two phases. From roughly, if we take the founding of Rome is supposedly 753 BC, that's the Roman dating of their own history by Roman historians in the 2nd century BC. Archaeologists have confirmed that it's a pretty accurate dating. It was in the mid 8th century BC that the area that we call Rome today was first settled. From there down to 14 BC is the Roman Republic. And this is that period in which Rome is largely ruled by an aristocracy. There was a brief period of kings, foreign kings actually, Etruscans. The Romans kicked them out and have a hatred for their early history of the idea of one-man rule. But in 14 BC, during the first century BC, for about 60 years, the Roman world, it's a long series of civil wars between various Roman generals. And the man who emerges is the nephew, the great nephew of Julius Caesar, Octavian, as he renames himself Augustus Caesar, and he creates the Roman Empire in terms of emperors. And so roughly then from 14 BC into the 460s AD is the Roman Empire. And as I mentioned, I gave you a list there of the Roman emperors. The first of whom is Augustus. He is mentioned in Holy Scripture, Luke chapter 2, verse 1. It is a military dictatorship. It's not only a dictatorship, it's a military dictatorship in which one man rules, and he rules by virtue of the power of the army. That means, therefore, this is critical in understanding, I think, Constantine. It means that the emperor has to preserve the support of the army. And one of the key reasons why I believe in the authenticity of at least the, let me put it a bit of a, from the integrity of Constantine's commitment to Christianity in terms of his own thinking. He may not have been a Christian, but he thought he was. And the reason why I believe that it was, from his point of view, a genuine commitment was because the army was the last major bastion of paganism in the 4th century. And here he was going against all of the he would have been going against all of his major generals, which would have been a completely idiotic political move if he was not convinced some sort of inner reasons compelling him to embrace Christianity. The early Christian response to this dictatorship of the empire is found on a number of levels. One that is a constant theme through this early period is 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter is describing how should we view those in authority. 1 Peter 2:13. Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme, or unto governors as unto them that are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of them that do well. For so is the will of God, that with well-doing ye may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. And then verse 17, honor the king, or honor the emperor. And the early church will find itself at odds with the empire, but this great theme of although they will disagree with the empire, where the empire requires them to disobey God, nonetheless, there is this other sub-theme of the importance of the early church honoring those who are placed in authority over them. And then the last major point I want to make here before we move on to looking at Greco-Roman religion is that significant numbers of that empire were country dwellers. Christianity is an urban religion. It makes its headway, and there's a recent book by a man named Rodney Stark called Cities of God. I don't agree with everything in the book, but it's quite a remarkable study of, from a sociologist's point of view, of the advance of early Christianity. And I think, to my satisfaction, he shows fairly conclusively that early Christianity was first of all planted as it moved out of Palestine in large urban centers that were also ports on the Mediterranean. Early Christianity was found in large urban centers that were, first of all, that were ports on the Mediterranean. And one of the literary reasons why we know early Christianity was an urban phenomenon was because this word, pagan, actually comes from a Latin word. That means a person who dwells in the country. A paganus is a country dweller. And you can't always, it's one of the great challenges of doing a study of a word and tracing its meaning by its etymology is that often does not work. In this case, it does work. The word paganus, why did it stay on in the church's memory as a description of unbelievers? It's because the major bastions of unbelief as the church grew were in the countryside, not in the cities. The cities became centers of Christianity. You see that actually in the Apostle Paul's strategy, I think his missionary strategy, which sets the pattern for the early church's growth. Paul's missionary strategy is to go first to large urban centers where there was a synagogue. Synagogue would be the initial place where he would preach. He might be there 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks. Inevitably, he'd be expelled because of the offense of the gospel. But a church would be formed, and then he would, after nurturing that church, elders being appointed, he would expect that church then to reach out to surrounding villages. He would go on to the next large urban center. Sometimes he ends up in smaller centers that, by the providence of God, he is led to, like Derbe and Lystra. He goes to Pisidian Antioch in Acts 13, but it's driven out of the city. He ends up in Derbe and Lystra, both of which were described by Greco-Roman writers of the time as holes in the wall. You know, these little, obscure little towns. But in the providence of God, God brings him to these places, and it's there that he meets, for example, Timothy, one of the believers. And but normally Paul's strategy is large urban centers, and that becomes Christianity in these early centuries is an urban phenomenon. And again, that contrasts with some of the experience of the church in later years. And then religiously, the Greeks and the Romans were unashamedly polytheistic. Their world was filled with innumerable gods and divine spirits. And whereas we see, we go out, I'm looking out the window there, and I see trees. What the Romans would see would be, they'd obviously see the same physical object we see, but they would see also physical objects imbued with divine spirits. What I see are trees that have been created by a maker and one creator. What the Romans would see would be trees. They obviously look like trees to him as they would to us, but these things have gods in them. And fields and forests and rivers are filled with divine beings. And one of the things actually the gospel is doing, on the one hand, it is asserting that there is one divine God over all things. It is also, to some degree, de-divinizing the universe of the Greeks and Romans. It is taking away the divinity that the Greeks and Romans gave to the material universe. Paul mentions this in 1 Corinthians 8:5. His culture knew of many gods and many lords. Or Acts 17:16, what grieved the Apostle Paul was the multitude of idols that he saw. And from the point of view of the early church, these gods did not exist. 1 Corinthians 8:3. They were nothing in the world. Or Acts 17:29. They were something shaped by art and man's devising. On the other hand, when we get to the letter to Agnias, we will note there's a little text that does speak that while these gods did not exist, that does not mean that the worship of these gods was something that did not have supernatural overtones. There were powers at work in the Roman world. But the gods that the Romans worshipped were masks, as it were, for these various powers to entrap men and women's souls. In the world in which the gospel was made its headway in these early centuries, many of the old Roman gods were no longer being worshipped. Jupiter and Mars and Venus, they were falling into that the old classical Roman religion, which actually was the Greek religion. The Greek gods were taken over. Mars was Ares. Venus was Aphrodite. Jupiter was Zeus. They were taken over, baptized into the Roman world, given Roman names. The Romans themselves had very few actual gods that they brought from their ancient backgrounds. The Romans, one of the things the Romans were, and this enabled them to grow as an empire, they had a marvelous knack for adapting and assimilation. And the one thing, for instance, let me veer off very quickly here to backtrack and illustrate this. One thing I had not illustrated, again, this is very different from the European experience of slavery in the 17th and 18th centuries and the 19th centuries. You could start your career as a slave and end up a wealthy aristocrat, a governor of a Roman province. And that happened. We know of men who started their careers as slaves, were able to purchase their freedom, and move up through Roman society until they ended up ruling a Roman province, or being wealthy millionaires hosting parties at which the emperor would come, and your career had started as a slave. I don't think we have any illustrations of a man who started as a slave ending up as an emperor. But there was a mobility in the Roman society, and part of that mobility was rooted in the Romans' ability to assimilate. In this regard, they were completely different from the Greeks. The Greeks, you started your life as a slave, you'd always be a slave. And the Greeks suffered from enormous xenophobia, which hindered their growth. The Romans, what they did, one of their abilities was to go into an area and Romanize it. They'd conquer an area. The first a couple of generations, significant numbers would be slaves. But what the Romans would do is they'd bring in their culture, and particularly Latin language and Roman religion. But what they would do to make, from the point of view of many of these peoples they conquered, make it palatable for them to be conquered, they'd actually take all the gods of these other peoples. So the Romans would come in to say when they conquered the Celts, they'd bring their own gods, and then they'd take the Celts' gods. And this is really one of the major problems the Romans have with Christianity. As far as they're concerned, the more gods you got, the better. There's all kinds of powers out there. Might as well placate them all. Christianity bothered them intensely, not because they declared that Jesus Christ was God, but because of its exclusivity. That's what deeply angered them. And we have a number of texts written by pagans basically saying to Christians, look, there's all kinds of gods out there. There's many ways to God or to the divine. Why do you have to insist on there being one way? But by the time the early church is beginning to make its way in the Roman world, many of the classical Roman and Greek and Roman gods are no longer being worshipped. Instead, new deities are being forged. And in particular, the goddess Isis, who was an Egyptian goddess, and the god Mithra, who is Persian. And Mithra was very popular in the Roman army. And Isis was a very popular cult among Roman women. Along with all of this, there was the worship of the emperor. Now, let me give you some ideas the way, and I want to talk about the worship of the emperor in a second, but let me give you some idea of the way in which idolatry permeated the Roman world, which made it difficult for conversion to Christianity. Every household would have its own gods. I'm going to use a term that comes out of a Buddhist context, but it's a term of god shelf. Every local family would have a shelf on which there would be deities, little statues. The Romans also engaged, unlike the Greeks, in ancestor worship. And they would sometimes have little statues of gods, but also their ancestors. At the beginning of the day, the head of the household, the father and husband, would lead his family in obeisance to these various gods and ancestors. No holy books to be read, but various prayers, rituals. What was critical about Roman religion is that you memorized various prayers, and they were to be said exactly in the way that they were passed down to you. Exactly. You didn't vary it. And so that's within the home, which made it very difficult. If the head of the household converted, it would be fine in one sense for the rest of the household. If the wife converted, it would be very difficult. And that's why you've got a passage like 1 Peter chapter 3 that deals with women and advice to women about how to deal with pagan husbands. Some of the pagan response to Christianity was to urge husbands to make sure their wives didn't speak to strangers. Way of trying to prevent Christianity infiltrating Roman households. So that's a one level. At a second level, let's say you were a carpenter in the city of Antioch. In the city of Antioch, there would be what we might describe today as some sort of union. I'm not sure that's the appropriate word. But there would be a place where those who were carpenters in that city could go to learn about jobs, etc., and to fraternize. Part of the fraternization with other carpenters, which was crucial to your getting employment, would be to engage in worship of an idol, a god who is believed to help carpenters. You see this, by the way, in the Acts chapter 19. The silversmiths in the city of Ephesus, And in that text, one of the major things that they got money from was creating little mini statues of the goddess Diana. People would come to Ephesus. Ephesus, is the temple of Diana, was one of the great ancient wonders of the ancient world. And to remember your visit and to keep in touch with the goddess whom you had supposedly worshipped when you're there, you take a little statue home, stick it on your god show. Who made those statues? Well, the silversmiths did. And Diana was the patron goddess of the silversmiths in Ephesus. And so to get work as a silversmith, you had to fraternize with these people, part of which would be they would meet maybe in kind of a clubhouse or whatever. They might meet at the temple of Diana and have a meal together, but part of which would involve idolatrous worship. So you get converted. It's going to be difficult for you finding a job as a silversmith in a given town or any of the various guilds. And what was important was not whether or not you believed in this worship. What was important was going through the ritual. And one of the reasons why these two religions were prominent, Isis and Mithra, was that traditional Greek and Roman religion had degenerated, if I can use that phrase, degenerated into mere external ritualism. What was important was that you went to the temple, said the prayers, offered the sacrifice. What you actually believed was another question. And a number of the trials of early Christians was simply, look, please, just simply offer the sacrifice. It wasn't, they're never asking these early Christians, look, we want you to believe in the Greek and Roman gods, just simply offer the sacrifice. Go through the external ritual. No big deal from the point of view of the Roman world. It doesn't matter what you believe, as long as you turn up and do the externals. But from the Christian point of view, doing the externals was hypocrisy when they believed that there is one God and one Lord Jesus Christ, and all these other gods and goddesses are idols.